You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Getting my head all wired. You need to know this. Oh, a lot of stuff coming up today, by the way. We're going to be talking about the war on women in our second hour and our third hour. Phil Kirpin is going to drop by. We're going to be talking about wind energy. I've got a rant that I want to get into, and I'm going to get into it in some length in our third hour, about how Paul Ryan might be one of he may have done something that could force President Obama to do something that could guarantee him that he wins this election. We'll see. So anyway, we'll get into that in the third hour. But a lot in the news. Sarah Palin, for example, knows nothing about freedom or the history of this nation. Now, that's not exactly breaking news, but considering the news that is breaking today, like the Chicago's teacher strike, it's worth hearing from the former gubernatorial quitter turned celebrity about what she thinks freedom means in America. Listen to this.
There's an estimation of an unintelligent voting bloc out there. I think that President Obama is assuming will continue to want to get free stuff, despite free stuff will replace freedom. And he's just assuming that that voting bloc will be large enough to get him back in there. But I just pray that Americans will open their eyes between now and November when they know that they'll have to make that choice between free stuff or freedom. You can't have both.
Yeah, and that unintelligent voting bloc, this is Palin code for minorities. I mean, you know, holy cow. Anyhow, she's wrong. This is not an election between freedom and free stuff. What Palin doesn't get is that freedom requires a certain amount of free stuff. Things like good free roads, free clean air, good free courts, free regulatory agencies to make sure that your food, drugs, and toys are safe, a free social safety net to catch people when they fall, be it falling and breaking their necks, as Social Security will cover you, or trying to start a business and falling into bankruptcy, like Henry Ford famously did 7 times before he got it right. And then there's the stuff we've paid for out of every paycheck during our entire working lives that the Republicans want to snatch away and give to the banksters at the big insurance companies and on Wall Street, the earned benefits that they call entitlements, like Social Security and Medicare. Right-wingers like Sarah Palin just want to give the money that we've paid into Medicare and Social Security to their campaign contributors on Wall Street and to the giant for-profit insurance company. This is not rocket science, right? Privatize it. Profitize it. Figure out a way to make some money off the commons. Let your millionaire and billionaire buddies skim a little off the top. Sarah Palin refers to all of these things as free stuff, but what they really are is they are the vital components of a civilization. President Franklin D. Roosevelt nailed it in 1936 when he said, "Necessitous men are not free men. Liberty requires the opportunity to make a living." Well, you're not free if you're sick and you don't have health care. You're not free if you're hungry and don't have access to food. You're not free if you're cold and don't have shelter. Despite what you heard at the RNC in Tampa, no one built it on their own. The self-made man is a myth. You know, there are millionaires and billionaires in America because all of us came together in the last 2 centuries, sewed a social safety net together, starting with President George Washington signing legislation to pay for housing, food, and health care for the poor, giving away a bunch of free stuff so that Americans could be genuinely free to chase down the American dream. Kennedy talked about this when he was fighting for Medicare.
This argument that the government should stay out, that it saps our pioneer stock. I used to hear that argument when we were talking about raising the minimum wage to $1.25.
Yeah.
And those who say that what we are now talking about spoils our great pioneer heritage should remember that the West was settled with 2 great actions by the national government. One, in President Lincoln's administration when he gave a homestead to everyone who went west. And in 1862, he set aside government property to build our land-grant colleges. This cooperation between an alert and progressive citizenry and a progressive government is what has made this country great. And we shall continue as long as we have the opportunity to do so.
There you go. I guess Sarah Palin missed that speech, too. Maybe she was too young. I don't know. But now two of the most essential freedoms in America are free public education and free association, the right to unionize, which brings us to the top story of the day, the Chicago Teachers Union strike. After contract negotiations fell through over the weekend, the Chicago Teachers Union declared a strike and walked off the job this morning. This is the first time Chicago teachers have gone on strike in over 25 years. Altogether, 29,000 teachers and school workers are joining in the strike to demand better pay, better working conditions, and to stop the march toward privatization of the city's schools. This is a really kind of edgy and delicate time. I don't know how to describe it other than time, moment in time, you know, whatever you want to call it, that here's this strike, and the Republicans, of course, are trying to use the fact of the strike to trash President Obama. Hey, Chicago's his hometown. Rahm Emanuel used to be his chief of staff. Rahm Emanuel's now the mayor. They got a strike on their hands. What are they going to do? Look at this. They don't know how to handle their own teachers. Okay, quack, quack, quack. And the Republicans, of course, that hate, you know, they hate unions. They're trying to make it out like, oh, yeah, these teachers, they just want, you know, more from us. Actually, what the teachers are fighting for is a good public school system that works. This is one of the areas, I don't know how few they are. I haven't sat down with a list of Rahm Emanuel's, you know, what he likes and what he doesn't like and what he's up for and what he's not up for. But this is one of the areas where, you know, I had Arne Duncan on the show last week and I argued with him. I said, do you really think that anybody whose bottom line is money, who's motivated by profit and not by desire to educate kids, is going to do a better job than a nonprofit organization, nonprofit schools? I mean, if you're going to have charter schools, if you're going to have separate schools that are not part of the public school system, and you're going to take my tax dollars or Chicagoans' tax dollars to pay for them, then at the very least make them not for profit. And I say that as somebody who's been on the board of directors of a not-for-profit school here, well, in New Hampshire, here in the United States, for 30 years. My wife and I started it. Go to hunterschool.org. You can read all about it. And I can tell you, you know, I don't get paid for being on the board. None of the board members do. And nobody's getting rich off this thing. And if we were to sit down in our meetings, in our board meetings, board of directors meetings, and ask the question, how can we make more dollars off this rather than how can we best serve these kids? I'd hate to think what would happen to that school. So, you know, respectfully, I'm with Thomas Jefferson, who started free public education in the United States with the University of Virginia. I'm with Abraham Lincoln, who, as Jack Kennedy, you just heard Jack Kennedy talking about, took thousands, tens of thousands of acres of land in the United States that was owned by the government and gave it away to start land-grant colleges like Michigan State University. Free colleges.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you know, Louise says it's going to be on my tombstone. It all started with Reagan. And when Reagan was governor of California, he got rid of those free colleges. Yeah, right. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. Oh, man, this is Sarah Palin. Just you know, this is Sarah Palin working. This is the modern version of Ronald Reagan's welfare queen rant. Right? This is the modern version of it. Ronald Reagan said, there's this woman who, you know, drives in her Cadillac to pick up her welfare check. And I don't even think he said that she was African-American in his characterization of her. But everybody understood that that's what he was talking about. And in that context, listen again to Sarah Palin, what she has to say, you know, keeping in mind that you know, President Obama has the vast majority, if not virtually all, of the black vote locked up, and a large chunk of the Latino vote. Here's what Sarah Palin apparently thinks of these voters.
There's an estimation of an unintelligent voting bloc out there. I think that President Obama is assuming will continue to want to get free stuff, despite free stuff will replace freedom. And he's just assuming that voting bloc will be large enough to get him back in there. But I just pray that Americans will open their eyes between now and November when they know that they'll have to make that choice between free stuff or freedom. You can't have both.
Yeah, free stuff, like free roads to drive on. Holy cow, are you kidding? Seriously? You know, knowing you don't have to hire a taste tester to make sure that you don't die from your food, knowing that your food is safe. And even that's imperfect. 3,000 Americans die every year from food poisoning, but still, it used to be hundreds of thousands. Or, you know, if you scaled it up to the size of the population of the country, the equivalent thereof. What, you mean free, make sure that my medicine is safe? Are you kidding? Free? A free court system that is, you know, 60-70% used by businesses? Businesses like ExxonMobil that pay no taxes whatsoever, even though they use the court system to enforce the contracts that they make? Free stuff like our court system? We can't have that. And then there's that free stuff that you've paid into most of your life. You know, they take that out of your paycheck every single week for Medicare and for Social Security. And then be 25 years old and fall and break your neck and you've been paying into Social Security just for 5-10 years. And, hey, it'll cover you for the rest of your life. It is an insurance. You know, a third of Social Security payments do not go to old people who are retired. They go to people who are disabled. Literally widows and orphans as well. Paul Ryan, when his father died when he was a teenager, his family was, you know, went on Social Security. Now, they weren't broke. They were doing well. His grandparents had made a fair amount of money building highways with Eisenhower's federal funds. Oh, yeah, free stuff. I don't get it. You know, what kind of is the free stuff that she's talking about unemployment benefits? Because I don't know anybody who's getting unemployment. Maybe you do. You know, maybe there's some conservative out there who can call in and tell us the actual name of somebody. Or tell us, you know, from their firsthand experience, not from watching Fox News, of somebody who is getting unemployment benefits and really doesn't want to work. Now, I'll tell you right off the bat, there are such people out there. Ben Franklin talked about this when he went to England. England back in the mid-1700s actually had a fairly reasonable social safety net for the extremely poor. And Franklin in his autobiography wrote at some length about the challenge the government has. And the George Washington administration faced this challenge, by the way, by paying for poorhouses here in the city of Washington, D.C., to provide housing, food, and medical care for the deeply poor people. Immigrants fresh off the boat, people who had fallen into poverty, people who were disabled. George Washington signed a bill to take care of those folks. And Ben Franklin talked about how, you know, there was fair number of people on the dole in the UK back in the day. How do you know? How do you do it? And acknowledge, you know, there's always going to be 2, 3, maybe Well, probably not 4%, but they say structural unemployment is typically around 3% in any country. In other words, that's the percentage of people who just, you know, they don't want to work. And you can't do anything about it. But should we really be so stupid as to say, you know, there's a small percentage of people who are not going to work, who are going to game the system. And therefore, for the you know, genuine, legitimate people who would rather work, people like you and me, who want to make a decent living, who want the self-respect that goes with it, who want the independence that goes with it, that we should say to those people, you know, if your job gets shipped off to China, if Bain Capital comes in and says, okay, you guys build a platform out in front of your factory like it is happening right now with, what's the name of that company? It's been scared out of all of us. I got too close by saying Solyndra, and that's not it. But in any case, that company, the Bain Capital right now, they had the employees build a platform. And then the management from Bain Capital came in, stood on the platform, gathered the 300 or 400 employees together and said, we're going to shut this factory down in 6 months. And in the meantime, a bunch of Chinese people are coming over here and you are going to train them in how to do your jobs because we are shipping your equipment to China. And by the way, Bain Capital gets a huge tax break for that. And when Democrats proposed in Congress to take away that tax break, Republicans filibustered it. So are you really going to say to those people who genuinely want to work, but Bain Capital shipped their jobs off to China, oh, sorry, no unemployment for you. Oh, you got kids? Tough. No food stamps. Let them go hungry. Learn how to eat the bark off of trees. You know, grass, you can make soup out of it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I can just hear the new Republican motto. Grass soup. It's good for you. The Ann Wigmore Diet. 28 minutes past the hour. So what is freedom? Is freedom the right to die like a dog in the gutter? Does freedom mean that you have, like Henry Ford did, an opportunity to run up substantial debts while trying to build something? And then if you can't make it work, the ability to wipe those debts clean in bankruptcy. He declared bankruptcy 7 times before he finally got it right. Henry Ford did. Is that freedom? He couldn't do that today. The bankruptcy laws have been so tightened. So, what is it? Damien in New York City says here you disagree with me. You go right to the front of the line. What's up, Damien?
How are you, Tom? You know, I'm fairly conservative, but I do find you a bit more on the reasonable end of the
sane
spectrum with my liberal counterparts.
All
but
right.
I guess one of the things that I'm actually wondering is, you know, nobody is very detail oriented, whether they're on the right or the left. And I guess, where is the line? You know, you talked about freedom, right?
Yeah.
What is freedom? Well, if you're saying that you can't have freedom without shelter, well, are we supposed to give everybody a house for free?
No.
And then if that's the case,
no, but I'm not suggesting that, but I am saying that if there are people who literally do not have a place to stay, that, yeah, I agree with George Washington. We should provide housing for people who are absolutely destitute.
Well, no, listen, I'm fairly conservative. I run conservative circles. I don't think there isn't anybody that I know who would want people out on the street. I think that's a little
okay,
bit
so
of
you're
a
arguing
control,
in favor of the idea that housing should be a right.
Well, I'm for
even if it's a crummy housing. I mean, even if it's like a homeless shelter, you know, where I don't know if you've ever been in a homeless shelter, but I'll tell you, it's crummy housing. But at least
sure.
It's something.
But I'm for a safety net. But I think, you know, if you remember the governor from New Mexico, who, you know, I was really taken by her speech at the GOP convention. She said, you know, what do we do? Do we talk about welfare as a hand up? or do we talk about it as it's a way of life? And I think too many people on the left talk about it as a way of life for certain people who they make excuses
for
being able to get to work.
Please name one.
But
one person on the left who takes that position.
Constantly. No,
this is a straw man that you will hear constantly on Fox News and from the right. But please identify one commentator, one politician, one elected official in the history of your life who has suggested that welfare should be a way of life. Name one.
Well,
one liberal.
They would say that, but hold on. If you look at
you cannot name one because nobody on the left takes that position. It is a phony baloney position that people like Sean Hannity and others on the right promote. It's called a straw man. You create something that doesn't exist and then you argue against it.
Well, look, I'm more of a libertarian, so I'm more of like a Ron Paul guy. But I will say this: you know, if you look at it from like President Clinton during his awesome speech at the DNC. He said, look, you know, he was bragging about what he had done, and he was talking about welfare reform.
Right.
And, you know, prior to when the Republicans took over both houses of Congress in 96, he didn't sign welfare reform, if you remember. He only signed that after the GOP controlled both houses. So, and now he takes credit for it. So, I mean, you know, look, both parties are very disingenuous when it comes to things. And it's just, I think now people.
What does that have to do with this core argument of whether the what Sarah Palin is referring to as free stuff is not important to actually have freedom in a free society?
Well, my point is how much freedom are we talking about in the sense of, like you had said, you know, we need to have, you know, you can't be free if you don't have health care. You can't be free. You know, look, here's my bottom line.
I'm not saying you can't be free if you don't have a car. I'm not saying you can't be free if you don't have fancy clothes. I'm not saying you can't.
Right.
But there is, you know, Abraham Maslow identified his hierarchy of human needs. There are these basic things that are essential human needs, whether you have an IQ of 150 or whether you have an IQ of 50,
right.
Whether you're, you know, fully able or whether you're severely disabled. It doesn't matter. These are basic human needs. The need to eat.
Well,
the need to regulate your body temperature.
We've been arguing this. I think people from the right and the left have been arguing this, you know, back and forth for a long time. But if you do look
Not
at
really.
It, I think so. I think, look, you know, like, look, the bottom line is I talk to people all the time in my profession and they tell me, well, you know, you can't raise a family on this. And my answer is a little cold sometimes, but it's, well, who ever guaranteed that you have a right to have a family? My thing is this: if you can't support a family on what you're making, then either get another job or you shouldn't have a family. Then, you know, the Constitution never guarantees that you can have the house on the hill with the 2.5 kids and the, you know, and the picket fence. You know, there is no guarantee.
Again, please identify for me one liberal who has ever suggested that everybody in America should be, you know, instantly and magically earning the 50, 60, 70,000 bucks a year.
I will tell you right now, Barney Frank. Barney Frank was on the floor. No, Barney Frank was on the floor of Congress talking about the right of home ownership. If you don't believe me, you can look it up on YouTube. He was arguing about the right of home ownership. There is no right to home ownership.
Yeah.
It's called, all right, you have a right to home ownership when you have enough money for a down payment.
Sure.
When you have the credit and you have, so there is no right.
Yeah, I would submit to you that your description of Barney Frank was taken out of context because never proposed legislation that would give everyone a house.
Well, why do you think Maxine Waters, who was praising her good friend who was running Fannie and Freddie, we're saying there was no problem with Fannie and Freddie. There's no, we don't have a problem with Fannie.
Again,
and Freddie.
You're
like,
wandering off into the weeds here, Damien. Back, you know, let's get back to this core point of at what point? Where do you draw? I'll tell you where I draw the lines, okay? And you can tell me where you would. I draw the line where I think as a society, we need to have a social safety net that will catch people in the areas that literally have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the ability to be alive. In other words, healthcare, housing, food, and arguably transportation, public transportation, so that people can get to work if they can get a job. Now, I'm talking about things like buses and subways and whatnot. But and I would submit that those things should be, you know, if people don't, if they literally don't have the bootstraps to pull themselves up by, those are the bootstraps that we need to provide to people.
Well, I'll tell you this. This is where I draw the line, is that, you know, before you start making decisions on, you know, having a family and, you know, and having your own place and having, you know,
I'm not talking about those things.
We should be planning better. We should be planning better.
You know, again, you're going off on a tangent here, Damian. Where would you say, and I would add to that, by the way, the ability to start your life over again, to reinvent yourself, which means going back to the bankruptcy laws we had before the Bankruptcy Reform Act of a couple of years ago. And, you know, so that it's more like the way it was when Henry Ford and Thomas Edison were around. And you can try and try and try and try. And if you fall and fall and fall and fall, finally you get it right. And boom, you got Ford Motors. I think that those are the core things. And then in terms of those things that should be provided for by government, I think education is a core thing that we should all have a right to education. I agree with Thomas Jefferson on that, and that anybody who's capable of being educated should.
But if we talk about education for one moment, and I know you've been giving me a lot of time, and I appreciate that. Like, if you look at schools, say near where I live on Long Island, mm-hmm. people will complain, like Al Sharpton or one of these, you know, activists will say it's not fair that Garden City High School or their school district has an uber amount of money, and then you look at Roosevelt High School or Hempstead High School, and they don't have much.
Right.
My answer to that would be, well, then it's a local issue, and it's up to the local people to determine whether how good their school district is.
So you're a fan of the Lucky Sperm Club theory.
What?
You're a fan of the Lucky Sperm Club theory. If you were lucky enough to be born to parents who are affluent or live in an affluent area, you know,
absolutely
good on you. You get to grow up and be Mitt Romney. But if you are in the unlucky sperm club and you're born into Appalachia in West Virginia, then, you know, where there's no money and there's not enough money, you know, there's not enough of a tax base to even support schools, then screw you.
Not really, because if you look at it, there's a school in Kansas, all right? It's a farming community, which they don't have enough, they don't have a lot of money. They don't have any smart boards there. It's basically out of a barn. They have a very high SAT rate, scores. They have very high placement for
you know, those unusual exceptions, Damien, are the things that prove the rule. I mean, I could say the same thing about the Amish schools. You know, you're going to find exceptions that prove the rule, but the general rule is that if you look at the states that have the best educated, you know, the best outcomes, they're the states that have money. They're the states that have a solid tax base. They're mostly the blue states. And you look at the states that are sucking down the federal money, that are taking your and my tax dollars, they're mostly the Republican states. And if you look at the nations that have spectacular educational outcomes, the two highest ones in the world are Denmark and Singapore, which are completely different countries. Denmark is a democracy. Singapore is almost a dictatorship. But in both those countries, they pay the teachers the same as they pay doctors.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which brings us back to Chicago. What do we do about that? Anyhow, we'll get back. We'll have more conversation about this right after this.
You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, "This is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town."
Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Peter in Philadelphia. Hey, Peter, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate listening to you every day and feel honored that you picked me up here. Just a couple of quick items. Number one, the libertarian fellow who just called and was complaining about, and you called him spot on several times, that, you know, all the liberals want people to have
free
a
stuff.
Handout, not a hand up. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I was surprised you noticed that the representatives you complained about, one gay representative and two African American representatives, when I pointed out that bias, I have a conservative friend who sent me that YouTube video that this guy referenced, and I wrote right back. I said, "Do you realize this is a dog whistle?" And I pointed out the nature of the representatives. He's like, oh, I never even noticed. I was like, you got, then that's your problem. That's part of your problem right there.
Yeah.
You claim you
and
don't notice.
And that video that's going around in conservative circles is very selectively edited.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's they're out there now. The articles are talking about, are conservatives really racist or not? Well, of course they are. If you have to ask the question, then you are. Secondly, I think libertarians and Tea Partiers are really, they're just conservatives too embarrassed to admit that they voted for Bush twice, quite frankly.
May well be. But what baffles me is, I mean, Romney and Ryan right now are running on a platform of, let us do what George Bush did, only do more of it. Yeah. I mean, that's literally their platform. Bush cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires several times and expanded the military and didn't put it on the credit card, the national credit card, and said
Absolutely.
He was going to close loopholes. He ran on that. I mean, they're basically saying, let us do what Bush did, only more of it. And, somehow that's going to magically help us. And I just, it just baffles me.
But the reason why they get.
You're still on.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. The reason why they get an audience for that is because what a psychologist buddy of mine used to call shame and humiliation, and how people's lives are run around that. And even religion, if you think about it, there are people who for their whole life have held a certain belief, again, whether it's religious or, trickle
political.
Down or whatever it might be. And for them to all of a sudden say, hey, you know what? Actually, Ryan and Romney have it wrong. I've got it wrong. I've been wrong my whole life. It does make sense to grow from the middle class.
That's a very difficult. You're absolutely right. That's a very difficult thing to acknowledge, and it takes time for people to come to those realizations, and it takes a lot of information for them to come to those realizations. But one of the things, Peter, that really strikes me is how often people call into this program and say, I always thought I was a libertarian, or I always thought I was a conservative, or I always thought I was Republican, and then I started listening to your show. And not just my show, but I started listening to progressive commentators on Sirius Left or on, fill in the blank for the station. We've got some great progressive stations around the country. And I think that, people waking up is a very real, I think it happens in America. I think it happens far more than most of us think. Peter, thank you for the call. Lee in Chicago listening to one of those great progressive stations, WCPT. Hey Lee, what's up?
Hi, Tom. At the top of the show, you were talking about all the free stuff, and I just wanted to remind you that I pay taxes, and I'm a part owner, so none of that is really free. We all own that as part of the commons.
You're absolutely
right.
We employ
those people as part of the commons. So to even call it free stuff is false.
Yep. And Alaska's right up there. I mean, Governor Palin, that state is right up there in terms of taking federal dollars. In fact, I believe they're number one. They may be number two behind Mississippi now. But, they're way up there in taking federal dollars versus the number of dollars that they send to Washington, D.C. So major redistribution of wealth there. Thanks a lot for the call, Lee, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Mike in Fairfax, Virginia, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, Mike, what's up?
How's it going, Tom? I wanted to talk about Rahm, and I'll try and get back to that if you'll let me. But you asked for people who specifically looked at welfare as free stuff for – I'll give you a couple names. Plowart and Piven describe welfare as a way to bring down the capitalist system. They basically have a strategy where the more people you can make dependent on government subsidies or government aid, government welfare, then you have a compliant voting base.
Yeah, but see, it's never going to be more than a couple of percent because people, unless you engineer your society so that those people have barriers to the workplace. So, if you back, when you had redlining, you know what redlining is?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Back when you had redlining, where if you lived in certain neighborhoods, banks simply would not loan money into those neighborhoods. So those neighborhoods
but
are basically screwed. Back when we had segregation, back when we had groups of people that we said, you're never going to be better than a maid. That's it.
But
you might be able to go into those kind of situations and say, okay, not only have we screwed you, but now we're going to give you something. And, then you have a situation that doesn't work. But if
you can
succeed in breaking down those barriers and give everybody opportunity, then what you're going to find is the vast majority of people, well over 95% of not just Americans, but all human beings, and I would say probably well over 97, 98%, would much rather have a job, even a not so great job, than be getting a check from the government every month and living off it.
So
unless they're retired.
Strategy was to make so many people get on entitlements that you could bring down the system and affect change on capital.
No, nobody's ever. You know, that kind of conspiracy theory is the kind of stuff that used to come out of the John Birch Society. Nobody has ever advocated that.
Let me give you another name then. Barack Obama gave an interview when he was a state legislator with a Chicago radio station. You can YouTube this. And he said that the Warren courts didn't go far enough and that the Constitution described was a charter of negative liberty, said what the government couldn't do, not what the government must do to support you.
That's true.
And the implication there is that he felt that it was the federal government's job, to basically somehow through social justice right wrongs of the past, and that has just wealth redistribution written all over it. And the only way they can do that is through the social programs.
Well, hang on just a second. If the government commits crimes, don't you think the government should pay for those? Or are you in favor of just letting people get away with things?
Well, you know what? We keep talking about the past.
You brought it up.
Real quick. Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
So you think if the government commits a crime against a group of people, that it should never be held accountable to that?
I didn't commit the crime. Why am I paying for it?
Well, you're part of the government. I mean, if you voted those officials in, if you were complicit in that, yeah, why not? Okay. Mike... We'll live to debate another day. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carrie Lucas on the line. She is the managing director of the Independent Women's Forum and co-author of the book Liberty is No War on Women. IWF is the Independent Women Forum. IWF.org is the Independent Women's Forum website. And at Carrie Lucas and at IWF on Twitter. Carrie, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
It's great to have you with us. You're a little dim there. If you can get some light.
No, I'm
on
sorry.
Your face.
I don't have anything in the front here to light us up. So
okay. All right. Well, that's fine. You wanted to talk about the war on women, and or at least what Democrats are characterizing as the Republican war on women. I don't. Recent examples: Eric Erickson, you know, going off on likening the DNC to the vagina monologues. You got now tens of thousands of women who are saying enough already, fire the guy. Ann Coulter regarding Bill Clinton, and you know, making jokes about Bill Clinton and Sandra Fluke. I mean, isn't there a point at which that might be a weaker example, I think, but isn't there a point? You know, women making 78 cents for every dollar men make. Isn't there a point at which you say enough already?
Well, I mean, Tom, first of all, I mean, it's obviously different personalities say offensive things all the time. And I don't think that, you know, we need to go through the catalog of horrifying and, frankly, misogynist things that have been said by comedians on the left about Sarah Palin and women. And that should be out of bounds. But really, when the Democrats are talking about the war on women, it's not name calling in the public arena, which you guys are in control of Hollywood more or less. So you guys have the kind of have the
well, don't you think comedians get a pass? I mean, you know, the history of the court jester is that the court jester was the person who could speak truth to power and not have his head cut off.
Well, I don't know. And certainly there's been a lot of you know, it's not just politicians. A lot of media figures who are supposed to be serious journalists also say really horrible things, calling Laura Ingraham a conservative slut. There's all sorts of examples.
Well, you know, when Ed did that, he apologized profusely afterwards, took himself off the air for a week.
I don't think it's a useful conversation on who has a worse record of insults. But what I do think is a much more serious issue is the Democrats trying to pretend that an entire perspective is inherently hostile to women, that I, by being a supporter of limited government, am somehow part of a war on women. And the thing that I find, you know, you and I disagree, Tom, on how or what policy prescriptions benefit people in general and women in particular. But I don't think it's, you know,
Let's try going up to 60,000 feet and looking down in the largest possible context. Would you not agree that most businesses in the United States are run by men?
Well, actually, I mean, that's more complicated than certainly most of the top CEOs in Fortune 500 are disproportionately male, but women are now more than half of managers. So when it comes to day-to-day decisions, women are in positions of power throughout the economy.
So the glass ceiling has been raised. So the glass ceiling has been raised.
No, it's certainly been raised, you know, and I think that when we've talked about this before, that there's a lot of reasons why women aren't as likely as men to pursue the top jobs. And there's been tons of research on this, and the Department of Labor comes out with new studies all the time that shows that women on average work fewer hours than men. Full-time working women spend less time in the office than men on average. And it's really no surprise that somebody who works more hours ends up making more. This is, again, we're talking in the aggregate. And this is why the wage gap numbers are so misleading. And
yes and no. I mean, those stats of the differences between men and women are for the same person doing the same job in the same place.
Know that the 77 cents on a dollar is just that is the that is full-time working people. It doesn't control for industry, it doesn't control for education, it doesn't control for hours worked. Once you start controlling for hours worked, it starts disappearing. Hours worked alone makes up a good almost
so 10, you don't it, in other words, Carrie, you're suggesting that the fact that most businesses in the United States are controlled by men does not mean that. Well, actually, let me just lay out the logical argument that I was going to make, and you know, maybe you can punch a hole in it. If you have a group that controls the business world, and historically that has been white men, and they have as a, let's call it an unconscious policy. People are most comfortable hanging around with people like them, right? So they have an unconscious policy of choosing only to have white men as, you know, in the areas of power to which they're closest. Is there any force outside of government that could break that up so that people other than white men might have access to those high positions of power?
Tom, it's called the free market, because if you literally, one of the things I find, you know,
how does the corporate free market do that?
Listen, because of competition, because if you could literally have a company where you could hire your entire, you know, instead of, if women are all making 77 cents on a male dollar, then my goodness, go start up the company, hire all women, pay them 83 cents, you know, a little bit more than they're making elsewhere, and you are going to crush the competition.
Well, they've done that looking at women CEOs. I'm sure you've seen the studies. The women CEOs in the United States make less than male CEOs do in Fortune 500 companies. Fortune 1000 companies, excuse me.
You know, this is, you know, there's going to be examples of, you know, when you talk about Fortune 500 companies, there's a lot of variation between number one and 500. So it's really, it's anecdotal and misleading. And I think, frankly, insulting to try to always just say, oh, well, you know, this.
Okay. Well, back to the original question then. We had a corporate free marketplace in the United States by and large, up until Reconstruction, until the 1870s. When we put into law that you couldn't have slaves anymore, and you know the corporate free market in the South maintained slavery just fine, thank you very much, until government broke it up, and then the corporate free market maintained child labor until the 18-teens when government broke it up. And then the corporate free market.
What is it that you want to do? What is it the Democrats want to do, Tom? How are you going to make it so I'm going to like raise? What are you going to do to raise my salary?
I think that, frankly, putting into law the Equal Rights Amendment that says no person shall be discriminated against based on gender is a pretty simple formula.
I can sue. Like, people sue all the time. So what is that going to do for me?
Well,
like,
you can really only sue because President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter law. Because prior to that, the Supreme Court ruled, the five conservatives in the Supreme Court ruled, that let's say you've been discriminated against for 18 years, like Lilly Ledbetter was,
that
you have to file within 6 months of knowing it.
Statutes of limitations when you can sue somebody. So we all know, and maybe it should have been a little longer, although now you're going to have times where people can sue, you know, decades. And so companies now are going to have to live in fear of litigation.
Well, no, Lilly Ledbetter doesn't, you can't reach into the past with laws. What's that called? I want to say ipso facto.
What is it? Of course. Yeah,
ex post facto.
But now, so if somebody making the decision about hiring a woman today has to think, boy, you know, 30 years from now, she might try to, like,
if you decide to pay her less, yeah.
Well, no. If they offer flexibility, Tom, a lot of women out there, like myself, who are moms, I do not make that much money, and one of the reasons is because I want to be home with my kids.
But that's part of your agreement. That's part of your contract with your employer.
But how do you think employers are going to say, do you want to take a chance? I don't know. If I was an employer, I might say, sorry, everybody's got to be here 9 to 5.
No, the Lilly Ledbetter law even allows for that. You know, that's allowed for it, law. If I come to an employer and say, you know, I want to care for my kids 2 months out of the year, and so, you know, let's cut a deal. I'll work for less pay. And there's no law against that, and I'm not suggesting there should be.
But you could. But I
what I'm saying is that the corporate free market has never solved discrimination in the workplace. It never has. I don't understand why you think it will in the future.
Because, Tom, this is we're in uncharted waters. You know, the types of the invitation for litigation means that nobody knows what the rules will be in the future, and you know, you can get a jury to award just about anything.
No, it means everybody knows what the rules are. They're right there to see, doesn't it?
We're in uncharted waters. But this isn't even what the Democrats are talking about.
Okay.
Women. They just want to silence us.
I leave you with the final word. Carrie Lucas, IWF.org. Thank you, Carrie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Carrie's new book. You can find it in all the usual places. Liberty is No War on Women. We'll be right back.
Said we must let Detroit go bust, like paying ship jobs overseas. To make more gold out of work to go, and replace them with cheap Chinese. Well, healthcare plan will be good for the land, should gates be allowed to wear. Wall Street banks deserve a thanks, or controls on risk instead.
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Karen in Seattle. Hey, Karen, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Oh, okay. But I have a lot to say, and I have on so many subjects, so I don't want to take too much
time. Please pick one.
Okay. The gal that you were talking to, what was her name? Carrie Lucas. She's a young gal. I saw that on DirecTV, on Free Speech TV. She doesn't realize all the freedom she has that could be taken away because of the thought she has.
For example?
Hello?
No, I'm here. For example.
That's my cell phone. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And they don't understand. I am a 55-year-old woman who worked most of my life and couldn't get a lot of great jobs because of that. You know, you could never earn as much as a man. And then I developed lupus when I was 35.
Ouch.
I'm now on Social Security now, benefits.
Yeah.
And I paid into those benefits those years I all worked. Why do they always think that is a free thing?
Yeah, well, it's not.
Paid for that when I worked.
Yeah, of course.
And now when I get it, they want to make me feel like I'm a bad person because I'm laid up with lupus.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really what you when you talked about all that, we need a catch-all for people. People like the guy from Long Island was talking about, you have to prepare for those things. You can't prepare for some of life's things that come along.
No.
I guess I get emotional because when you've been sick, mm-hmm. you understand that you need those catch-alls.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I'm totally
with
you.
A lot of those people don't understand. My son's a nurse right now, and he's working in a nursing home.
Mm.
And he has a guy there that has MS.
Mm.
He's 35 years old. He got it when he was about 26. He's now in a wheelchair.
Wow.
How is he supposed to plan for that?
Right. Well, that's what you're pointing out, Karen, is the essential brutality and inhumanity of the libertarian and Republican worldview. And
yeah.
and it's
like you're called by that super sperm, or you know, the lucky sperm.
The lucky
if
sperm club. Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to be born into that, great. And I'm all for people making money. I'm not saying that they shouldn't. But we have to think of the people that can't at times.
Right. We are rich enough to both have millionaires and billionaires in our society and have a decent social safety net and pay people decent wages and pay women equal pay for equal work as with men. Karen, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the – you've made your point so well. Thank you so much. Malcolm in Park Forest, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Malcolm, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great.
This remark that Sarah Palin made
has
another aspect to this. When she starts talking about free stuff,
with
the rednecks and the narrow-minded, corporate fascist sociopaths, have an image of an overweight black woman in the project, single mother, that's on welfare.
Yeah, let me play Palin's clip again, just so people know. You know, somebody might have just tuned in here, Malcolm, and it's been almost an hour since I played that clip. So let me just play that clip real quickly, so people know what it is you're talking about. Here's Sarah Palin yesterday on Fox News.
There's an estimation of an unintelligent voting bloc out there. I think that President Obama is assuming will continue to want to get free stuff, despite free stuff will replace freedom, and he's just assuming that voting bloc will be large enough to get him back in there. But I just pray that Americans will open their eyes between now and November when they know that they'll have to make that choice between free stuff or freedom. You can't have both.
Yeah, right. And while she's doing that, she's got this giant Star of David on. It totally baffles me. But in any case, go ahead, Malcolm.
That's a subliminal message to the brain of the nitwits on the right, the Tea Partiers, and these sociopathic senators and congressmen and billionaires and things to evoke that subliminal image in the back of their brain.
That's dog whistle.
Or black people on welfare. That's really what it is.
Yeah, it's dog whistle stuff. And it's in the midst of a national conversation about how President Obama is getting the minority vote and Mitt Romney's got to get, 60-some-odd percent of the white vote or he can't win. And,
and
right in the middle of that national conversation, Sarah Palin comes along and says, Obama's depending on a certain voting bloc. Well, what's that certain voting bloc, Sarah?
That's right.
Yeah, you got it. You totally nailed it, Malcolm. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. John in New Haven, Connecticut, listening on Sirius. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, John. Jesus. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. What's up, John?
Tom, if you could give me a couple of minutes, I'd like to say some things. I'm not...
We don't have minutes, but, go for it quickly here, John.
Okay. People that talk about welfare and the poor, they're ignorant fools, and I'll tell you why. If you want to talk about welfare, what about the welfare that we give the rich? What about the welfare we give bankers? What about welfare we have in this crony capitalism society where it's not capitalism? Because if it was capitalism, we'd have gold in our pockets and not pieces of paper.
We give more money to the oil companies in the United States in the form of corporate welfare, in the form of actual cash dollars, checks the government writes to them, than we do to all the kids in America on food stamps.
I know.
Just the oil industry.
I think it's 60 times the amount. I mean, there's been studies, and that guy that called earlier and was saying, I didn't commit the crime, so therefore people think that racism is gone. And I called you once before, I'm sure you remember. People should learn about the scramble for Africa, which is still going on, or the fact that we have Rhodes Scholarship, which Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar. Cecil Rhodes was a monster who was killing people because the British Empire privatized colonialism, and now I don't know how.
Well, Alfred Nobel invented dynamite, too. I mean, that just because you take their money doesn't mean that you're endorsing their monsterness.
Wait, you're talking about Cecil Rhodes?
Well, whether it's Cecil Rhodes or whether it was Alfred Nobel, I mean,
there's a difference, Tom, between inventing dynamite and Cecil Rhodes killing black people over resources.
I grant you that. I agree with you, John. There is a qualitative difference there, but I don't think that makes Bill Clinton a monster. John, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, I didn't, it's going to be interesting. I'm going to have to dig into where the Rhodes Scholarship came from. I never put that two plus two together. I'll let you know after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I refer to the Lucky Sperm Club from time to time. Mitt Romney being born into a millionaire family. Donald Trump being given millions of dollars by his father. He squandered much of it, declared bankruptcy early on, and then kind of came back. The Koch brothers inheriting fortune from Daddy Koch. All these kind of the majority of billionaires in the United States didn't make it themselves. They inherited it, or at least a good chunk of it, or at least the ability to make it. But some even took it a step beyond that. And Mitt Romney, in this very revealing piece of audio, and I hope the audio is good enough that you can hear it and understand it, he starts out by saying 95% of life is set up for you if you were born in this country. And he's talking about how a friend of his at Bain told him this. And then he says, and I remember going to, and then sorry to bore you with the stories, but I remember when, he says, back when I was working with Bain, and he tells the story of going to China to buy a factory. And he proudly brags about how there were 120 women to, you know, working in these 12 women sleeping in a room and or working in an area with one little bathroom at the end, and how, you know, the horrible conditions that they lived under. And yet, and there was gates, you know, and fence around the outside, and but the factory owners told him that the fence was there to keep people from coming in, because so many people want to work in this place that during the Chinese New Year, when they let these women out, some of them don't come back, and there's this long line of people looking for the jobs. Now, there may be some truth to that, or maybe not. But in any case, I just found the whole thing absolutely fascinating. This is over at Daily Kos today. And here is Mitt Romney admitting using Chinese labor and also kind of setting the whole thing up with his idea that, you know, the Lucky Sperm Club is kind of a cool thing, that he was born, you know, white and wealthy in America. And isn't that great? Listen to this.
5% of life is set up for you if you're born in this country. And I remember going to bore you with stories, but when I was back in my private equity days, we went to China to buy a factory there. It employed about 20,000 people.
So he went to China to buy a factory. It employed about 20,000 people. Now, he goes on to say, and they were all young women between the ages of 18 and 22 or 23. They were saving for potentially becoming married, he says. This was the great excuse for only women, only these young women, all this kind of thing.
And they were almost all young women between the ages of about 18 and 22 or 23. They were saving for potentially becoming married, and they work in these...
And then he gets into this, and they work in these in this factory, and they made small appliances, and as they were walking through this facility, seeing them work, the number of hours they worked per day, the pittance they earned, living in dormitories with little bathrooms at the end of maybe 10 rooms, and the rooms they have, only 12 girls per room.
Huge factories, they made various small appliances, and... as we were walking through this facility, seeing them work, the number of hours they work per day, the pittance they earn, living in dormitories with little bathrooms at the end of maybe 10 rooms. And the rooms, they had 12 girls per room.
This is pretty impressive, right? Three
bunk beds on top of each other.
On top of each other. You've seen them, you know, you've seen them. And everybody says, yeah. He says, and around this factory was a fence, a huge fence with barbed wire and guard towers.
And around this factory was a fence, a huge fence of barbed wire and guard towers.
And this is the point at which he says, you know, gosh, I can't believe that you keep these girls in. And they say, oh, no, we don't. The guard towers and the fences are not to keep the girls in. They're to keep people out.
And we said, gosh, I can't believe that you keep these girls in. They said, no, this is to keep other people from coming in, because people want so badly to come work in this factory that we have to keep them out.
People are just, you know, they're just trying to pour into these factories. They so badly want to work there. We need guard towers with guys with guns to keep them out. Otherwise, they might just, like, sneak in and work and then ask to be compensated.
They'll just come in here and start working and try and get compensated. So this is to keep people out. And they said, actually, at Chinese New Year, as the girls go home, sometimes they decide they've saved enough money and they don't come back to the factory. And he said, and so on the weekend after Chinese New Year, there'll be a line of people, hundreds long, outside the factory.
Hundreds of people outside the factory after Chinese New Year, looking for jobs, hoping that some girls haven't come back and they can come to the factory. And so as we were experiencing this for the first time, going to see a factory like this in China some years ago, this is probably...
that some girls haven't come back and they can come to the factory. And so as we were experiencing this for the first time, we came to see a factory like this in China some years ago.
The Bain partner I was with turned to me and said, you know, 95% of life is settled if you're born in America. This is an amazing land, and what we have is unique and fortunate. And fortunately, it is so special that we are sharing it with the world. Right now, this is just this is the most lucid and frankly honest expression of being a member of the Lucky Sperm Club that Mitt Romney has said. And I'll tell you, I was born white in America. I was not born a wealthy family. My dad was a tool and die maker. I never got anything from my parents. But I still consider, just being born in America, A, and white, and, B, and having some functional intellect. I mean, all of these things these aren't things that I went out and got. I didn't build that. That's how I was born, right? And so here's Romney kind of confessing to this.
A couple of years ago, the main partner I was with turned to me and said, 95% of life is settled if you're born in America. This is an amazing land. And what we have is unique, and fortunately it is so special, we're sharing it with the world.
It's so special, we're sharing it with the world. Yes, we're going to buy a factory where there's 20,000 young women who are working and living 12 to the room. I mean, isn't that cool? Yes, this is sharing America with the world. That's what we do at Bain Capital. Yeah, I have so many kind of cross currents of ambivalence and on the one hand, I'm kind of horrified by Mitt Romney bragging about how he's making money going to China and buying factories like this, and exploiting these young women. And on the other hand, I'm impressed that, I think he actually believes this story, that the guard towers and the fence are there to keep people out. Or he's a very, very good liar. I don't know. And his kind of confession that, pretty lucky to be born here. That's pretty amazing. So, anyhow, Carl in Everett, Washington. Hey, Carl, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just listening to your interview with your last guest there and listening to her talk about the discrepancy in pay, and I remember the very first time I heard this, and it was a discussion between two people were Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh gleefully quoting this CBO report that said that, as she said, all the differences and discrepancies in the wages could be explained away by fewer working hours, raising children, all their standard things. And I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. So I went home that night and looked at it and looked for some information about it. And there were two paragraphs in the newspaper. And the first paragraph was basically what they said. And the second paragraph, which they're both very short, said, after allowing for all these differences, women are still paid at a 78 cents on the dollar. So that whole thing, I've never heard anybody actually explain to them that, no, in fact, what that report said was that all those differences in working hours and conditions and raising children don't cover the difference in wages.
Well, thank you for that, Carl. I'll have to look for that CBO study. Maybe somebody in the chat room can help us track it down and find it. Or if you have it, if you would post it over at tomhartman.com.
I'll look and see what I can find.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you, Carl. Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Tom Hartman.
Uh-oh.
I'm so glad you sound better. You're obviously recovering.
I am.
Your voice was so iffy the first few days. I thought the man's been intubated. He shouldn't be talking.
Yeah. Well, I was. I actually did have, drains and tubes attached to me, and I was also fairly stoned on narcotics. Now I know what Rush Limbaugh went through, although I never got anywhere. I think the Thursday and Friday, the first two that I came back, and then the first two or three days of the next week I was taking painkillers when I was on the air. And I think it didn't sound so good.
Well,
but at least I was here.
I could tell with your memory you couldn't find words or names or stuff for a while there.
Yeah, that's a clue.
Listen, two quick things. I'm so sick of hearing conservatives talk about welfare being a life choice for a group of people. If you take the cash amount of money that a single mom would get on welfare and you put her in public housing and you give her food stamps and you give her S-CHIP, she still has to go get emergency food box at the end of the month, because none of those things are designed for people to actually survive an entire month on.
Right.
The program is set up to disincent dependence. And yet we talk as if these people are all happily going to do this for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
only if they have no other options. The other thing is,
and that's where things like structural racism become
real, and you need
to talk about them.
Yeah. The other thing is the conservatives that call you, and every time they make a totally bizarre point and you rebut it or whatever, or debunk it, they change the subject. Rebut it, they change the subject.
I've noticed that.
And I'm like, if I wanted to listen to Shrill and Stupid, I'd be watching Fox to start with.
There you go. Virginia, on the other hand, Virginia, it is important, I think, to rebut those points and to do it publicly, which, by the way, is one of the things that Fox does, only on the other side. They have liberals on, and they beat up on them. So I think that there's some value in it. Thank
you for
the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, frankly, I think that there's a lot of value in helping people learn how to win the water cooler wars, because that's what we all have to do at the end of the day. We'll be back.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
There you go. What did you say about this show? That's right. Okay, that's right. In the next hour, we're going to be debating wind power. Thank you very much for that. David in Pacifica, Washington, listening on AM 1090. What's up, David?
Yes, Tom. I was listening earlier to you with Mitt Romney's confession of the abuses that go on in China, and I've seen a documentary on the, I think it was Pirate TV on the Free Speech Channel in Seattle, and it was exactly the same story, but the towers were to keep thieves out, and the fact that the women were kept in because they didn't want them to get pregnant either, because people are normal, you know, human beings, they don't want to have them around their, you know, pregnant, they'd rather have them work hard,
right.
You know, and so they were released at a certain time of the year, and they were right, some of them didn't come back because of the abuses in these camps,
right.
And it's amazing that he would do a confession, but it was probably, he didn't ever expect anyone to hear these
things. What's amazing to me is that he would buy this factory and use it to compete with American workers in the United States. In other words, that he would manufacture goods under those circumstances in that country.
Unfortunately, there are corrupt people in China, too, that will work for these people and do their bidding and
Poor people. I mean, you know, it's poor people. You've got, you know, there's a billion people in China. I mean, there's only 300 and some odd million in the United States. There's a lot of people. There's an unending supply of cheap labor. And it's not just China. It's, I mean, all over the world. There are
That's
people
right.
who are very poor. You've got 7
That's
billion
right.
people on Earth, and only a billion or so of us are living at any kind of reasonable standard of living, and the other 7 billion are living at less than $5 a day, and about 2.5 to 3 billion of people in the world are living on less than $2 a day. So you go to somebody like that, and you say, hey, we'll give you $5 a day, and all of a sudden it looks pretty good. And the question is, do we want American workers to be competing against that? And historically, we've said no. But now with this, you know, global free trade and NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all of them, we're saying yes. And people like Mitt Romney then make it happen. Excellent point, David. Thank you. Dan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's up? Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Oh, hey, thank you, Tom. Listen, I'm a former Chicagoan, lived there 30 years and taught 10. And I was listening to you earlier talking to the gal about the money that you make, and if you don't, I think it was a gentleman, if you don't like what you make, make more. Well, I just wanted to make the point, in 72 when I started teaching, I was making $7,100, and I had an offer to go and work for Johnson & Johnson Incorporated. I would have made about 12 to 14 grand, almost twice.
Mm-hmm.
I chose to stay in teaching because, and I believe this in my heart, that teachers are people who really want to serve people. They love kids. They love what they do. And I decided it would be easier for me to go from a low-paying job to a higher-paying job in the future. Well, I'm glad I stayed. I taught 40 years. I live out here in Portland now. But, you know, people told me back then when I would have to work jobs painting houses and doing all kinds of stuff in the summer to make ends meet, they'd say, well, I'd say, we don't make any money. They'd say, well, if you don't make any money, why don't you leave? And I said, you can't say that to your teachers. You can't just say to them, oh, well, why don't you leave? Why don't the cops leave? Why don't the fire department leave?
Right.
We're people that really are an integral part of our society. And I just don't think that people understand how hard the job is. So my hat's off. I'm a third-generation union man. And, you know, hats off to the people in Chicago. Tough fight.
Yeah.
And like out here in Oregon, they want to take away our retirement, you know, our PERS. And last point I wanted to make was this, that teaching is a job that historically has been using women. And I saw that, and I saw it over and over again. And, like, you know, you had the conversation about equal pay for women and all like that. Mm-hmm. Well, women, by and large, you know, are the majority, especially in the elementaries and that. And they work so hard. All teachers do, but especially some of these ladies in the elementaries. And they sacrifice their time from their families and their money. And people, unless you have somebody in education, people just don't understand that, and they don't know how tough it is. And those guys and gals that are working in the South Side and West Side of Chicago, they got a tough road to hoe,
oh, yeah.
And they deserve every dime they get.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and I'm totally with you. It's being a teacher, particularly in an inner-city school, is a major tough job. DiCarlo in Oakland. Hey, DiCarlo, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Great.
I hope well.
I am. Thank you.
Hello.
And I hope the same for you. DiCarlo, if you got us on a speakerphone, you might want to take it off speakerphone.
Yes, I have it off speakerphone.
Yeah.
Well, what I was wanting to say is just to give you an example of everything you're talking about with education. Here in Oakland, we have a school that is called Learning Without Limits, and it was built with public money. Well, after the final stone was put in the school, the principal then said, we don't want to be public anymore. We want to be private.
Right.
So the school has been built with public money. They've now converted it to a public school. The irony is this, is that there is another school there, Global Families, on the same campus that is a public school. And it is dilapidated. The rooms get over 100 degrees. They don't have all of the necessary supplies, and et cetera. And yet, the public school is dilapidated, and the private school that was built with public funds is brand new. I don't understand why. And the school board approved this.
Yeah.
I don't understand. To me, this is the personification of what we're going through as trying to keep public education alive and surviving.
Yeah, and it's the ghettoization of public education. And, you know, we've seen this movie before. It's what happens is when you have, quote, school choice, and particularly for-profit versions of school choice, is that the for-profit organizations will come in, they'll leverage public assets. I mean, I've got a clip from a speech by Jack Kennedy back in 62 where he was talking about how we pay 65 to 75% of the cost of every hospital and every school built in America. And Bill Frist's family became billionaires buying up these hospitals that were paid for with public funds and flipping them private. And now you've got these charter schools coming in and doing the same thing, taking public facilities, getting them on, you know, a dime for the dollar, and turning them into for-profit operations that over the short period may look good, or, you know, if they just teach to the test and rigorously just teach to the test, they may test out well. But, you know, what happens is that the students who just can't make it in those private schools or in the charter schools get dumped into the public schools, and eventually the public schools just become, you know, overwhelmed. And underfunded. And I'll, you know, as I said earlier, and DiCarlo, thank you for the call. As I said earlier, the two countries in the world with the best public school outcomes are Singapore and Denmark. And in those two countries, teachers are paid the same as doctors.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. In 1856, maybe it was 1865, one or the other. I'm pretty sure it was 1850s. Well, one of those 2 years, Colonel Drake drilled the first commercial oil well in the United States. And within 30 years, John Rockefeller actually was getting subsidies from the various states to run his drilling operations in their states or bring his refining operations to their states. And, you know, we've been doing federal subsidies for most all of the 20th century. I mean, this was back in the 19th century, in the 1800s, that we were subsidizing oil. This year we will subsidize oil companies to the tune of $3 billion, not to mention that's what we're writing in checks to them as welfare, not to mention the huge tax breaks. I mean, you know, ExxonMobil paid nothing last year in taxes, made $400 billion in profits. Phil Kirpin is on the line with us. He is the president of American Commitment, nationally syndicated columnist and author of Democracy Denied. Phil Kirpin, K-E-R-P-E-N.com, is his website. And, Phil, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I understand that Americans for Prosperity and some of these other groups are leading a huge coalition opposing the extension of tax breaks for wind energy. We are in the United States right now, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. I've got the chart in front of me, and it shows all those various states. We're producing 48 gigawatts of electricity from wind power. Now, that's the equivalent of 48 nuclear power plants in the United States right now. How is that not a good thing?
Well, the first large windmill to generate electricity for electric power purposes was built in 1888 by Charles Brush. It's a technology that's now over 100 years old, and the idea that we need to lavish it with vast subsidies, I think, is nothing more than a pure corporate giveaway, similar to those oil subsidies you were talking about. And I think we ought to get rid of all the subsidies and allow these technologies to rise and fall on their merits.
But the simple reality is that, you know, in Texas, for example, where 20% of their electricity is produced by wind power, they're producing 10 gigawatts, 10,648 watts of electricity every year by wind power. This enables them to say to Saudi Arabia, no, we don't need so much of your oil. There's a national security issue here, Phil.
Where's the oil connection? Electric cars?
Yeah.
Missing the connection.
Well, and you know, you've got some electricity in the United States that is produced by oil. I'll grant you that it's the minority of it, but some electricity is produced by
Texas.
Oil.
Not in Texas. There's a very small amount in the Northeast. You know, wind power is generating about 3% of U.S. electricity. But, you know, every
3.4%.
Time you build one of these industrial wind installations, you got to build the natural gas plant to back it up for when the wind isn't blowing. And right now, with the price of gas being so extraordinarily cheap, it really doesn't make much sense to build a wind gas combined installation versus
that's why you
just
have,
building.
That's
gas.
Why you have either A, smart grids, or B, you have local community wind power or wind and solar power. Why don't we do what Germany did with solar panels?
There's very few places where the economics of it makes sense. I mean, one of them for a long time was thought to be in Oregon, where they could use wind in conjunction with hydroelectric.
Oregon is producing
behind the dam.
Two gigawatts.
Just came out for the end of the wind tax credit because they are now overbuilt with wind to the point they're actually allowing water to go over the dam. So it's just pure waste. And so, you know, I think the tide is turning on this one.
The Oregonian? Which is an out-of-state-owned, rather right-wing statewide newspaper. I mean, I lived there for
Tom, you think the
years.
Oregonian is right-wing?
Yeah, yeah. I constantly was, you know, I did a talk show in Oregon, too, for 5 years.
Yeah, I've always thought of it as one of the more left-wing papers.
No, it's owned by a conservative family in New York State. And I believe, if my recollection is correct, or corporation anyway, the Oregonian is not a left-wing rag at all. Now, there is a good weekly, Creative Loafing, I think it's called. I'd have to go back and look. But in any case, there's a great weekly there in Oregon,
they're
producing 2 gigawatts of electricity.
There are tremendous corporate interests supporting these subsidies, and, you know, the vast majority of these subsidies go to rural areas, to red states, to Republicans like Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican whip, who's a big supporter of wind subsidies. I'm surprised you'd be such a proponent of giveaways to big wind corporations.
I think until we've made the transition away from fossil fuels that are heating up our planet and destroying the future of our children and grandchildren, and until we've made the transition away from oil in particular, that, you know, is fueling wars in the Middle East and led directly to 9/11. I think until we've made our transition away from those things, that we should be continuing to subsidize these alternate forms of energy.
Well,
wind-generated
electricity doesn't really have anything to do with oil unless you electric
well,
cars.
Well, it does if you start electrifying your
infrastructure
cars.
Infrastructure and everything else. Yeah, I don't see that happening for a number of practical reasons. So I think they're sort of separate, the electricity.
More than half of all cars in the United States travel less than 50 miles on any given day. And, you know, in the capacity of an electric car, modern electric cars is around 100 miles. So
I would love to see it happen.
You can do it with 50%
of
our cars.
Promising technology, more so than the Volt even. But I think.
So let's subsidize those things. If you'd love to see it happen, let's make it happen. Just the same way we put a man on the moon. Let's make it happen, Phil.
I don't think it's that easy, because I think a lot of these policies just end up being farmed by corporate interest to harvest the subsidy dollars, and they'll do the minimum of whatever's required, but they don't really develop breakthrough type technologies, especially if they're not forced to have the discipline of actually competing in the marketplace.
These subsidies are not that.
Did with this wind credit, he wants to convert the wind credit to be upfront money, so you get 30% recovery immediately, and instead of being given out over 10 years,
sort of like the oil depletion allowance.
It's going to go from a $5 billion cost to a $12 billion annual cost under the expansion that the Senate's contemplating. I just don't think it makes much sense. This is not an infant industry. The technology's been around, as I said, since the 1880s, and this particular wind production tax credit's been around for 20 years, and they're not getting any more competitive economically. In fact, they're getting wiped out because of the collapse in natural gas prices.
The technology of producing turbines, machines that can capture the wind, is advancing constantly. The technology of the magnets and whatnot that are used to generate the electricity is advancing constantly. And, you know, we created the internet by government subsidy. We got to the moon entirely with government subsidy. We created our air travel system, our air transport system, with government subsidy. I mean, there's a lot of good things that we've done because we all got together and said, you know, we need to set this as a goal, and we're going to put some money behind that.
Did you like the internet better pre-1996 when it was government-controlled, or post-1996 when it was private competition and private broadband development that drove the internet forward?
It's hard to say. In the 80s, I worked for CompuServe. I ran a bunch of forms for them. I actually made some pretty good money doing that.
And all the rest of that stuff too. But
you could say it was government controlled.
How much benefit come from commercialization of the internet?
But we had like 15 people who were making a living, you know, just on a bunch of forms that I was running on CompuServe back in the 80s. I mean, it was so, you know, on this, and this was before HTML. And then HTML came along and started competing with us, and CompuServe got bought out by what's the company that used to do income taxes?
AOL.
It was first bought out by H&R Block, and H&R Block just bled the company dry, and then they basically died. But what does that have to do with anything?
Well, you brought up the example. My point is that I think at some point you can incubate a technology for so long, but after 100-some years, it ought to stand or fall on its own merits. The same point that you made with respect to fossil fuel subsidies. I think we ought to have...
Except that wind energy isn't destroying the planet.
Well, I mean, it depends who you talk to on that. Some would argue...
In other words, you're one of those people who looks at all that science on global warming and says, nah, I'm not going to pay any attention to that.
Well, I mean, some would argue that because wind energy requires a natural gas backup, it's going to further the production of
not necessarily.
Gas. Yeah, James Hansen says we should move almost completely to nuclear.
Let's put some money into coming up with a storage system like hydrolysis and hydrogen for wind energy, or do like Denmark is doing, where they're building a fleet of electric cars and you charge them during the night and you sell that electricity back to the city utility during the day. But anyway, Phil Kerpen, Phil, KERPEN.com is his website. Phil, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Have a good one, Tom.
You too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back right after the 16 minutes past the hour. Should we have wind power in America? Should we get off oil? Or was 9/11 just, it's just the cost of doing business?
Call my friends and tell them there's a party, come on by. Now just roll me up and smoke me when I die.
Oh, really?
Roll me up and smoke me when I die.
Okay, yeah, medical marijuana. You might remember back in May when Vice President Joe Biden went on Meet the Press to talk about equality, marriage equality in the United States. Here's what Joe Biden had to say.
I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying men are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
Now, keep in mind, President Obama had not said anything like that. So whether he meant to or not, by coming out in support of marriage equality before the president had, Joe Biden forced President Obama's hand. And just 3 days later, Obama himself was ready to make the same proclamation. Here it is.
For me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
So, and with that, the president pulled the United States into the 21st century, endorsing equal rights to married couples regardless of their sexual orientation. He also picked up a lot of support, both money, volunteers, and votes from the LGBT community. So thanks, Vice President Joe Biden. But now it's time for the president to stand up for another important issue. And just like the way the Vice President Joe Biden forced President Obama's hand on marriage equality, a different vice president, or I should say a vice presidential nominee, may be forcing his hand on this issue, too. Paul Ryan was in Colorado recently, a state that's poised to become the first in the nation to legalize and regulate pot. And Ryan was asked by a local news affiliate what his views were on medical marijuana. And here's what he had to say.
One of those questions you wanted him to answer was about medical marijuana. Medical marijuana is a hot-button issue here in Colorado and across the nation.
It's up to Coloradans to decide.
So even though the federal platform says marijuana is illegal, you're saying...
Look, my personal position on these issues have been let the states decide what they want to do with these things.
Let the states decide. As in, if the states vote to legalize medical marijuana, then Paul Ryan is okay with that. That makes vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan the first candidate for the executive branch in the history of the United States to say that the feds should stop their crackdown on medical marijuana when it's legalized by the states. It also puts Ryan at odds with both President Obama, who has used his Department of Justice to crack down on medical marijuana facilities that are legally operating under state laws, and at odds with his own presidential candidate, Mitt Romney. But back to President Obama. President Obama's Justice Department has conducted nearly 200 raids on marijuana facilities, roughly the same number conducted during George W. Bush's 8 years in office. Obama's been in office fewer than four. And those raids have occurred in 9 of the 16 states, plus the District of Columbia, that have already passed medical marijuana law, leading to 61 federal indictments, all since October of 2009. So somehow the president has allowed Paul freaking Ryan to get the jump on him on an issue with huge support among America's younger voters, particularly those who think that they're libertarians. See, I make this joke, libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. Well, here you go. Which means it's time for the president to have a Joe Biden moment, to wake up and change course on this issue. The election itself might be at stake. I mean, consider this. There are two third-party candidates running this election who could each pull a lot of votes from Americans who are upset with Nixon's failed drug war, in particular the crackdown on medical marijuana. Both Gary Johnson with the Libertarian Party and Jill Stein with the Green Party support legalizing medical marijuana. And between the two of them, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein are polling at around 5% right now. And right now the Romney-Ryan ticket may be peeling off those voters because Ryan has come out in favor of federal decriminalization of medical marijuana. That's a hell of a lot of votes. And considering presidential elections are rarely decided by a 5% split, then it's politically important. It's vital for President Obama to make a play for some of those supporters. He should come out and just say, okay, you know, if a state wants to have medical marijuana, we're not going to go into that state and bust people. I mean, politically, it's the right thing to do, and morally, it's the right thing to do. Medically, it's the right thing to do. So one of the best ways he can do that right now is by right now coming out in full support of medical marijuana and ordering his Justice Department to stop any future crackdowns. This is really a no-brainer. A recent poll shows that 74% of Americans want the president to respect state laws when it comes to medical marijuana. Only 15% of Americans agree with the president that federal resources should be used to crack down on medical marijuana. If the president thinks he can afford to ignore these polls or let Paul Ryan scoop up the medical marijuana vote, then in my humble opinion, he is making one huge mistake. I don't think we can expect Joe Biden to strike twice and push President Obama into making the right decision. But Paul Ryan has done the work this time. And President Obama should respond the right way. Legalize medical marijuana today at the federal level. It's the right thing to do. It's going to help millions of sick Americans. And it may just be the thing that can keep the White House in the hands of its current resident. If President Obama wants to win the White House, if he came out in favor of respecting states' rights, respecting the 10th Amendment, of saying that if a state votes to have medical marijuana to decriminalize it and regulate it, then we're not going to, you know, we're not going to come down, you know, with the heavy fist of the federal government on that state. If he were to say that, not only would he pick, you know, not only would it further energize his base, because there's a lot of young people in his base, a lot of old people in his base, who are looking at, you know, medical marijuana as something that can deal with a whole variety of medical issues, from glaucoma to cancer, and some of the side effects of the therapies associated therewith. So not only would he get those votes, but he would get the votes of the people who are libertarians, who there's a large chunk of them who call themselves libertarians because the Libertarian Party supports decriminalizing pot. It's like, you know, what's the government doing deciding what you're going to do in your own home, particularly pot? I mean, consider this: 50,000 people in the United States every year die from alcohol, from cirrhosis and diseases associated with alcohol. 50,000. You know the number of people who've died from overdosing on pot in the history of the United States? Zero.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think this is a no-brainer. And so if anybody in the White House is listening, hey, tell the president to take a cue from Paul Ryan and steal his thunder and do it quickly. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very infamously ugly, the good. Larry Flint. Flint, the controversial playboy and founder of Hustler magazine, is promising up to $1 million to anyone who comes forward with information on Mitt Romney's unreleased tax returns and or details of his offshore assets, bank accounts, and business partnerships. To show how serious he is about the offer, Flint took out a full-page ad in yesterday's edition of the Washington Post and will be running another ad in tomorrow's edition of USA Today. Mitt Romney wants to be president of the United States, yet he thinks it's okay to hide his dirty little secrets from the American public. Kudos to Flint for wanting to show Americans who Mitt Romney really is. The bad. Congressman Alan West. West thinks President Obama is actually a foreign operative working for the Russian government. Well, not really. But he does think that the Obama campaign slogan of forward is, quote, an old Soviet Union Marxist socialist theme, end quote. West made the remarks in a speech before the Republican-Jewish coalition. So where is West getting all of these ridiculous ideas? Probably from the likes of Breitbart.com and other far-right media outlets who have written extensively on the slogan and its possible communist ties. Unfortunately for West, he has also offended the entire state of Wisconsin, whose state motto is also forward. It looks like this comment might be one that takes West's political career backwards. And the very, very ugly Wells Fargo. Big Bank is so eager to foreclose on struggling American homeowners that it's foreclosing on the wrong houses. That's the case for Alvin Chochas and his wife, whose California vacation home was ransacked by contractors hired by Wells Fargo to foreclose on the property. Contractors broke down doors, smashed windows, and stole valuables from the house, while Chochas had helped, a house that Chochas had helped build when he was just 14 years old. Unfortunately, Chochas' house was not the house that was supposed to be foreclosed on, or looted for that matter. Wells Fargo has said that it was a mix-up with the contractors and that they are moving quickly to resolve the situation. Whether it was an honest mistake or not, this incident just goes to show how incapable and unorganized the big banks have become. In mere minutes, Wells Fargo helped to destroy the dreams of an elderly couple, and that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Oh, this is interesting. The Nation magazine has done an analysis of the Romney campaign's top 11 contributors. Seven of them are financial firms with significant offshore tax haven. Of the four who do not have tax havens themselves, two are accounting firms that do prolific business in setting them up for others. The worst is the Romney campaign's sixth highest donor, Citigroup, with 1,240 foreign subsidiaries. Wow. 1,240 offshore corporations that Citigroup has? And it's one of the six banks that control 60% of the U.S., an amount of money equal to 60% of the U.S. GDP? That is mind-boggling. That is really mind-boggling. Robert in Branson, Missouri. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, I just had a comment, actually a couple of them, a comment, first of all, about energy, and I'm
I work in the oil industry and have for ever since I got out of the United States Navy, but we are electrically independent. And I don't have a problem with subsidies for wind power, but to say we make wind power and by doing that, that reduces our dependency on foreign oil is inaccurate. We do not make electricity with foreign oil or foreign anything else.
By and large, you're right. We make electricity mostly with coal, and that coal is poisoning our people. There's not a single lake or river left in the United States where there's not the mineral. It's not iodine. Mercury. There's not mercury. There's not mercury dangers and alerts and things for the fish. I mean, this is the consequence.
I wouldn't argue that coal's a filthy thing, and we need to get rid of it. But being that somewhere around 90% of the electricity in the United States is made by coal, and we are electrically independent, whose lights are we shutting off?
Well, my suggestion is that first of all, we start. If we were to move our transportation infrastructure away from gasoline and diesel fuel and towards electricity, as many other countries have done, first of all, they've done it by having large mass transit systems that run on electricity. You take trains all over Europe. There's high-speed rail. There's normal rail. There's,
I work in Europe quite often, and the transportation there is we're not even in the same league, so I agree with that.
So we need to build that stuff out. And then secondly, more than half of all the cars in the United States could easily be converted to electric, and owners wouldn't notice the difference.
I disagree with that almost completely, because take myself. I'm an average driver in the U.S. I probably drive a lot less than most people. But they don't make cars that have the legs electrically that U.S. drivers need.
Well, the Chevy Volt does that.
No, actually it doesn't. That's why there's so many of them sitting on the lot, even though they're highly subsidized.
No, the Volts are actually selling quite well. And the benefit of the Chevy Volt is that it's an electric car, and if you can't find a plug-in to plug it into, you can put gasoline in it, and the gasoline motor will recharge it. So, you know, you can go hundreds of miles on the Chevy Volt on a tank of gas. I mean, you know, you can go more miles with the Chevy Volt on a tank of gas plus the electricity for the batteries than you can on a regular car. It's a good thing.
Nobody's doing it.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing them. They're selling well.
Well, there's lots of people doing it. Chevy's taking a loss. It's obviously the most casual observer. Chevrolet is taking a loss on the Volt.
Well, they're taking a loss on
a whole different thing.
They were actually, you know, the first year or so, they were taking a loss on a lot of their cars. That's how they got their, you know, they got back up. And you and I were helped propping up that loss through the subsidies to the auto industry. And then that will eventually be paid back. But my point is that if, you know, Nissan with the Leaf, they've got a very healthy business now in the United States. Toyota's come out with an electric car. GM has an electric car. The Chevy Volt
is not doing a healthy business either. And the reason
we need to build out an electric infrastructure.
The reason the totally electric cars don't work in the United States is, and I'm not arguing that mass transportation would, but they just don't have the legs that the average American driver needs. I took a trip or things I needed to do. I put the mileage on my car that I could not possibly have done in an all-electric car.
Right, and that's why if you had a hybrid car, you know, if you had a Chevy Volt, for example, you could have done that. You could have gone beyond the 100-mile limit of the electric battery and started using gasoline. But, you know, it's like, you know, we need to make that transition in America. And for strategic reasons, for national security reasons, most of our, you know, 95% of our transportation infrastructure, might be 96 or 97% of our transportation infrastructure is fueled by oil. And, you know, your point, my point, I agree with you. That is a national security problem. You look at other countries, much less than 90%. It might be 80% or 75%. Or even lower than that in some of the very small countries with very good mass transportation, their energy or their transportation infrastructure is not fueled by oil. And we need to be moving in that direction. And then we could get, and if we did that with solar power and wind power, and we started, you know, using that to power our transportation, our vehicles, we could be getting ourselves off foreign oil. That's a good thing.
I don't have a problem with any of that. I agree with you, other than the, you know, how wind energy was going to take us off of oil. It's just
But once you have an energy infrastructure where electricity is cheap and readily available, and because there are these alternative forms of electricity, of generation of electricity, and it's not producing, you know, mercury laden fish and food, and it's not, you know, destroying the atmosphere and destroying the planet, then, you know, that's a good thing for the country. That's, you know, moving forward. So anyhow, Robert, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. Betty and Corvallis, Oregon. Hey, Betty, what's up? Thanks for listening to KPFA.
Yeah, Tom, regarding the Republican war on women, I really think it ought to be called the government control of women, because the Republicans want to eliminate the Planned Parenthood. They want to eliminate contraceptives, abortion. They want to decrease in pay for women. And they also want to get away with the health care plan that covers a lot of women. Preventative issues,
right.
And all of that seems to be a government control of women.
Yeah, or male control of women. I think that the elephant in the room is patriarchy. But yeah, I'm totally with you. Well said, Betty. Thank you, Mike in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Got a minute to the break though. It's quick.
When you can talk about the wind energy.
Yeah.
One of the things you have to do is remind yourself that for any of these permanent magnets that are in these gigantic windmills, okay, 95% of all the rare earth elements, you need 2 tons to make one of these giant things. They all come from China.
Yeah, because China is operating a rare earth mine. We have rare earth mines in the United States that we have closed down.
Only one. It's Mountain Pass. It's in California.
Right.
It's going to be another 6 or 7 months before it's open. But the production numbers that can come out of there are not going to be enough to meet the demand if you're going to go push it as much as you want to.
Well, then you start looking for it elsewhere.
If the Chinese want to control this, the Chinese have complete control over this, and this is what they did with the Japanese when they had the fishing incident about a year or so ago. They held the entire country hostage. Okay, because of the fishing incident, until the Japanese backed off, okay, to allow it.
Using rare earth minerals.
Electronics industry.
Yeah.
Yes,
and the way that they got that monopoly was by selling those rare earth minerals at a low enough price that other countries like the United States, like that big mine in California, just closed down the mines because they couldn't compete. Mike, I see that as a national security issue, and I agree with you. Good point. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The Romney campaign's sixth largest contributor has 1,240 foreign subsidiaries. Foreign money funding Mitt Romney.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
You tell him, Leonard, like a good Canadian. maybe he's got U.S. citizenship. I don't know. He's originally from Canada. Anyhow, Mark in Weiss, Virginia. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You had a previous caller who worked in the oil industry, and he said electricity was not dependent on foreign oil. The equipment that mines for coal is very, very heavily dependent on foreign oil.
That's a good point.
I just wanted to correct them.
It's just the same thing with nuclear power. They say nuclear power is clean, yeah, but you've got to mine that uranium, you've got to refine that uranium, you've got to transport that uranium, and all of that is done with oil. Excellent point. And so whether it's coal or nuclear, you know, it's all done with oil. So let's just move to wind and solar and wave power. Now they're doing a commercial installation off the coast of Oregon in the next couple of months, the very first time. So there's a lot of possibilities out there. Thanks, Mark. Excellent point. Brian in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just caught some of the tail end of your conversation about getting off oil. And I just wanted to say it's almost like a pipe dream until when you start looking at the plastics and everything. This is a petroleum-based society. I'm driving right down a petroleum-based road.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree, but all of that constitutes a very, very small fraction of the percent of the oil that we're using. And that, and it contributes only minimally to global warming. So if we were to say we're going to, we've got enough oil in the ground right now in the United States to supply our petrochemical needs, our plastics, our pharmaceuticals, our pesticides and herbicides, and our, I guess I covered plastics, those needs for the next, 50 years or so, or 100 years. And now we're starting to develop alternatives to that, by the way. You can buy plastics now made from corn and things like that, pretty much any kind of hydrocarbon. But, let's say that we just do that. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, but, when you start talking about the electric car, my brother-in-law was actually working on the original electric car, and we've had deep discussions about the electric car. And until it can stand on its own, until you pull the government subsidy out of it, it's just not going to fly. Nobody's going to buy it. You'll have some French people point out to buy a Bolt or one of the Nissan Leafs. You'll have some people go out there and spend that kind of money, but the majority of the population will not until it can stand on its own.
Yeah, well, I think it's very close to it. I really do. And I think that as a national security issue, we need to be pushing this. This is... we are buying oil. We are spending, you and I, with our tax dollars, are spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year to defend oil lines, the oil shipping lanes, from across the Atlantic, across the Pacific, in the Mediterranean, in the Arabian, the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea, all of that stuff. We are spending hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax dollars to subsidize the oil industry via our Navy. That's crazy. And not just the Navy. The Navy, the Air Force, the Army, they're all defending these oil lanes. And then on top of that, we get sucked into wars in those areas. It just, it's not a good idea. Liz in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Something you said today made me think about this film I saw on PBS about Conservation Corps and how they reclaimed the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that this whole thing about big government, it's just a dog whistle for too many environmental controls that they want to get rid of.
Sure.
And
of course it is.
And And the other thing is, I have to tell you, you made me laugh so hard today. I really needed that good laugh when you played that tape that Sarah Palin said, the unintelligent people. Look who's talking.
Yeah.
And there's no such word as unintelligent.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, thank you, Liz.
I looked it up in Webster's.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks a lot for that. Mike in Wilmington, Vermont. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to update some information. There was a fellow who said that that one could not proceed with wind turbines because China controls all of the rare earth metals. That's no longer true. It was a while ago. But Lynas Corporation in Australia has the largest supply of rare earth metals. They produce in Malaysia. They ship over to Malaysia. And they just got approval, and they are producing rare earth metals now. And they're going to have a huge supply. There are other suppliers that are coming on also. And as for China, Japan killed 30 million Chinese. The islands off the coast of China are now in dispute because of a huge oil find in that area. So it's international oil going after those islands, not China.
That's very interesting. I didn't realize that. Thanks for that, Mike. I appreciate the heads up on it. Tim in Bristol, Vermont. Hey, Tim, what's up?
The thing about wind and solar and stuff.
Yeah.
That's the future. And all these other people are making excuses not to take that leap into the future.
Yeah, I agree.
Because the technology is, remember when tubes and then transistors and then computer chips, then microcomputer chips?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's going to do the same with, like you start building houses with solar panels. Everybody's going to feed into the grids. And you have places in the Southwest where it's thousands of square miles of desert.
Yep.
And a lot of it you can't use in Nevada because they've done underground testing. So put panels, solar panels, put up windmills, Rocky Flats in the west of Denver.
Yeah.
That's a huge natural.
I'm with you. Area. If just everybody in Phoenix was to put solar panels on their roofs and use that electricity to pay for to run their air conditioning, you'd have a huge decrease in the need for for electricity. And in fact, the wind power in Arizona, they're generating 238 megawatts of wind power right now. So that's a start. Thanks a lot, Tim, for the call. Great to hear from you. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, or tomorrow, we'll bring you the latest news and info from the campaign trail, plus Becky Bond, a Credo Action, about what they're doing to fight Citizens United and defeat the Tea Party extremists. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Not a spectator sport. It requires active participation, particularly in movement politics. So get out there, get active, occupy something, tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.